So I have a practice, a private practice in Santa Monica, and I see individuals and couples for relationship issues, codependency, and addiction. And I've been doing that for 25 years. And I was approached a year ago by Wiley Publishing to write this book. And I thought I had pretty much recovered from my codependency, and in writing it, I found there's even deeper layers, and that's the way it is. It's an ongoing recovery, like with alcoholism. You're not ever cured, but you continue to recover. Sometimes you're triggered, and then there's more as revealed. So let's get started. Codependency was first. Those are my websites. What is codependency.com and DarleneLancer.com. And codependency as a concept arose out of treating alcoholics in the 70s, and when family systems, you know, after a few decades got underway, they were looking at the families, and they originally called the spouses co-alcoholics. However, they found that after the alcoholic got sober, that the symptoms in the spouse continued, and that with more research they discovered that they pre-existed the marriage, and that it didn't necessarily mean that they came from an alcoholic family as they originally thought, that there are other dysfunctional family systems that bred this kind of behavior. If there was illness in the family, and as you see, Robert Subbe came up with a definition, because there's no one definition of codependency, of a prolonged exposure to oppressive rules. Then in the 80s, Melody Beatty wrote this seminal book, Codependent No More, and her definition was based on the relationship, along with another leader in the field, Ernie Larson. And then more recently, John Bradshaw looked at it as a symptom of abandonment in childhood. And then I came up with my own definition from my experience, and I think that these kind of relate to the environment or the relationship, but I believe a codependent is someone with a lost self. And so my definition is someone who cannot function from their innate feelings, their innate cues, but instead organizes their thinking and behavior around someone else, or a substance or a process. So my definition includes substance abusers and those addicted to a process like gambling, sex addiction, workaholism. But you can't really deal with the underlying codependency until you're abstinent from your primary addiction. Here's a diagram of the self, the codependent self. There's this core self that they can't access. It's surrounded by the critical shame-based self. I call it the inner critic. And then beyond that is the persona that they show to the world. And then there's the ideal self. And the critic is constantly comparing themselves to their ideal, whether it be successful enough, beautiful enough, good enough, giving enough. You know, it depends on each person's personality. They're always failing. So the symptoms of codependency start with, well, here's a summary that denial is called the hallmark of addiction. That applies to codependence too. Shame, which leads to low self-esteem, people-pleasing, guilt, perfectionism, painful emotions. A lot of fear is predominant, and anxiety, resentment, sometimes anger and depression. and dysfunctional boundaries, dysfunctional communication. I'm going to go over this in more depth. Dependency and control is pivotal. Codependents are caretakers, enablers. They have a warped sense of responsibility. So I've tried to make some diagrams to help make this more a holistic kind of idea, because I discuss it in a linear fashion, but everything is interrelated because we're exist in four dimensions, you know. So here you have a weak self, and from there you, and it's embedded in this critical self. So you see, can see if you have a weak identity, you're going to be dependent. You're going to have trouble with intimacy, trouble with autonomy. You're going to need to control others to regulate your feelings. But to summarize, it's someone who really can't access their core, and they don't know themselves. So the first thing in recovery, and I have a whole chapter on it, is getting to know yourself. And I'll give you more examples as we go along. That's an excellent question. So that would also mean you have poor boundaries and you're very reactive. You don't really know who you are. You're reacting as a definition. Everything is in the definition. Everything you do is revolving around something external to yourself. And so your communication is going to be dysfunctional because you don't know who you are, right? And because you can't access yourself, there's denial of needs and feelings. And then from the critical self derives your shame and all these negative feelings. So I mentioned denial. So there's degrees of denial and there's levels of denial. And I go into a lot of detail in that in my book. Actually, there's a whole chapter just on denial. And but sometimes people live decades in denial. You know, it's very funny because when people hear that I wrote this book, they say, oh, I know somebody who really needs that book, and how can I help them? And they won't listen, but I know they need help. Nobody thinks that it's them. It's they always know somebody who's codependent. And it's sort of like a dirty word, but you know, there's been estimate as high as 85% of the population is codependent, and I think it's maybe even higher in our profession, and I'll go into that. So, and then there's denial of if someone's addiction. If frequently codependents are either have a parent that's an addict, or they're involved with an addict, and they're in denial of that, or a problem. It could be abuse. And they don't realize they're being abused. And then there's denial of feelings. And again, there's degrees. So some people may have some access to their feelings, and they can make progress more quickly. But pretty much pervasive is denial of needs. And below that, wants. So when you say, what is a weak self? They can't access that. They don't know what their needs are, what their wants are. They're cut off from those cues that are physiological, even, that are, you learn to listen to them in infancy, in childhood. So how do you know if you're in denial, right? How do you know what you don't know or have a client, you know, like that? Well, if you're making excuses for someone, minimizing or rationalizing their behavior. Someone might have a partner that's they think is napping when they're passed out or tired when they're overdosing on pain medication. I talked to one client who insisted her spouse's problem was anger, notwithstanding that he stopped at a bar every night on the way home from work. So there's a lot of misunderstanding and denial around addiction. And workaholism. Some people just think, well, it's, you know, it's necessary. It's providing a good standard of living for us. But then they're lonely, or they're triangulating in the marriage. If you're concealing embarrassing aspects of a relationship, hiding it from other friends or family members. That's a red flag. Or making concessions and hoping that things will improve when you get married, when you have a child, if you just had more money, or if you had your own home, or whatever it might be, that then things will get better. Or you start changing yourself, thinking that maybe that'll make the relationship better. I did that for a long time before I really realized that I had problems of my own, instead of just focusing on the relationship. So shame is a primary feeling that underlies all addiction, and it's internalized. So shame is a natural, painful, very painful emotion, and it's a profound sense of inadequacy. But in my opinion, or personally to me, what makes it really more painful, that people don't want to experience it, is that there's an alienation of you from others. There's a loss of connectedness to people and a loss of self-cohesion, meaning you can't access other parts of yourself. All you are aware of is this profound sense of inadequacy. It's all-encompassing. It takes over everything. And some of these feelings that go with shame, and you can listen to them. Your clients probably won't express them. They may, but often not directly, expressly, because a lot of these feelings are unconscious, that I'm a failure, I'm unlovable. They wonder why they keep getting into relationships with people that don't love them. They're not aware that they have a belief that they're unlovable, or they're not good enough. They hate themselves. Some really, in extreme cases, have a very severe critic. They loathe themselves. They're always trying to do more to achieve perfection, or, you know, overproduce, work harder than anybody else in an office or something. They don't feel like what they're doing is enough, that they're bad. A real common one is they don't believe they deserve happiness, and most people aren't aware of that. They just have a very painful life and think, not even conscious, that they don't feel deserving of good. I had a supervisor here, George Oliver, decades ago, who said to me, you know, you help your clients deal with their pain, but at some point, what is really a challenge is to help them receive the good. And shame leads to low self-esteem. Self-esteem differs from shame, and shame is a feeling physiologically, and there's sweating, there's rapid heartbeat, there's a lot of physiological symptoms with shame also that I didn't go into. But with low self-esteem is a cognitive evaluation. How will you think about yourself? You don't like yourself, or that you can't do that. Or you don't like attention, you can't receive compliments, you don't know what you want, you don't trust yourself, you don't believe that your feelings or needs are important, that other people's are more important. And as I said, anxiety and fear are predominate with codependency. And these are some of the core beliefs or feelings that go with the fear. What if I'm alone? A lot of times people are trapped in unhappy relationships. They may not even be aware that they're afraid to be on their own. Some people are, but other people just feel like they can't leave. They really aren't aware of their fears of abandonment. And then the fear of getting too close. What if I lose myself in someone else? That's usually more unconscious. They pick people who are emotionally unavailable, that are safe. What if I'm judged, you know, or criticized, rejected? And then in performance and work, what if I fail? And then more unconscious usually is, what if I succeed? What if I'm more successful than my parents? Like violating the family system or the rules. Along with shame comes guilt. Codependents are always feeling guilty and saying, I'm sorry. If someone is sad, and they don't feel sad, they feel guilty. If someone has a problem, if they don't try to fix it, they feel guilty. I mean, they're constantly taking responsibility for other people's feelings. They believe everything's their fault in the relationship. And then the worst is that when they have negative feelings, they'll say, why do I feel this way? I shouldn't feel this way. I should be happy. Or I shouldn't be angry. So I mentioned dysfunctional boundaries, because this self is incomplete. It may be very fuzzy. They really don't know who they are, their identity is. You might even feel this with someone, like you could almost put your hand through them. And there's other people, you know, you can just feel that you can't get close to them. You can feel it energetically. So with no boundaries, it leads to enmeshment and merging, loss of identity in a relationship. Typically with borderlines, they'll get merged very quickly. And then broken boundaries, they might have a stronger sense of who they are in a work setting, but not in a relationship. Or they do well except when they're family. Or they're pretty good except with one child or something. Or until they're under stress. So it's kind of mixed. And a lot of times people in recovery and they start getting stronger, and then they go home for a visit, and then they just like lose themselves again. And then there's rigid boundaries, where people put up walls. And just because they're alone doesn't mean they're not codependent. They're afraid of getting too close for the same reasons. Or some people who have very mild, they have very weak boundaries, and they get into relationships, and they get hurt, they lose themselves, and then they boomerang, and then they put up walls. They don't want to get into a relationship. Well, I'm not going to go into detail, but you probably know already that boundaries exist in different arenas. There's emotional, which is the most kind of abstract, but it would be some of what I'm talking about when you take responsibility for other people's feelings, or you're reacting constantly to somebody else's feelings rather than what's your own feelings. And then material, physical, sexual, mental, and spiritual.
Material?
Yeah, it would be, you know, money, car, loaning your car. Okay. A lot of times couples get into arguments about how much they should, you know, give to their adult children because they have different ideas about boundaries. Things like that. A physical might be whether they have somebody stay in your home or your physical space, your emails, touching, whether you give a hug or a handshake, things like that. So if you have a whole self, you can be in a relationship and still maintain your identity. You're complete. So you can be close. And if you split these up, you see they're whole, they exist on their own. If you have weak boundaries, you lose yourself in a relationship. It becomes all blurry. And then dependency, of course, is a symptom because of the codependency. And this is also what happens if you have a weak sense of self. You need others to do things with. Codependents do okay usually in a structured situation where they know the expectations. There's assignments, there's a defined task, a classroom or bureaucracy or something like that, or with a friend, but left to their own, they either don't know what they want, or if they do, they can't seem to motivate themselves. They just have no mojo. I think this affects women more than men for a lot of reasons I go into in the book. But they can't say no. They have trouble making decisions on their own. They'll adapt to other people's interests, get into relationship, and, you know, don't see their friends, don't do their hobbies, want to spend all their time with their new interests, their new romance. And they can feel trapped, as I said.
It's a dependency. So I'm getting a little confused between dependency and codependency.
No, dependency is a symptom.
Okay.
Being overly dependent. Now, it's different than a dependent personality disorder. I mean, you could be codependent and, I mean, probably if you have that, you are codependent, but the reverse isn't true. So there's a definition of a dependent personality disorder. You can look it up in the DSM, and not all codependents are that to that extreme.
But dependency is a part of codependency.
Yeah. We all have dependency needs, but being dependent in an unhealthy way, or I could say pathological, but an unhealthy way, so that you can't function on your own, that's codependent. Good question. Then I mentioned dysfunctional communication. So they have trouble being assertive, because, again, it comes from this weak identity. They don't know who they are, and they have fear expressing who they are. So their communication ends up dishonest, manipulative. People-pleasing is a manipulation. It's kind of a passive manipulation. They're indirect. They ask a lot of questions. They avoid making I statements. If you try to have two codependents, like trying to decide on like what movie to see or what restaurant to go to, nobody wants to take a position. And if one does suggest a movie and their friend doesn't like it, they feel so guilty and responsible. So they're just taking responsibility for, okay, you cannot like it. It doesn't mean that I don't like you or that I blame you. Now, a codependent might blame their partner, but that wouldn't be healthy either. So there's a lot of blame, a lot of victim talk with, you made me do this, you never, you always, to avoid taking a position and saying what they want. They can't say no. So along with it comes verbal abuse. Trying to change other people with criticism and nagging, blame. And they do that to themselves, by the way. So if someone's blaming someone else, you can be sure before long they'll be blaming you. And that they're blaming themselves. So that's information for you to... Actually, I can talk about that in the countertransference to try to get them in touch with their inner critic. So, what are the reasons? Again, these fears. Primary is rupturing the relationship because of that need, that dependency need, and the need to be liked and the need to be approved of. So there's fear of retaliation, making a mistake because of their critic. They don't want to be criticized, so a lot of people won't take a position, express an opinion. And then other people sometimes don't want to say what they need or want. They don't want to be in imposition. They feel like they're going to be a burden because that's how they felt in their childhood with their family. And a lot of times people say, well, I don't want to hurt so-and-so's feelings. Well, I think that's their conscious reason, but I don't totally buy that. I think people act pretty much out of self-interest. So maybe they don't want to hurt their feelings because they don't want the person to be angry at them. They don't want them to lose a connection, emotional connection. So you can go deeper than just hurting their feelings. So all this leads to a lot of high reactivity with couples, if you're seeing couples. They're all bouncing off one another. You said this, you made me, you're making me feel guilty, you're making me angry. And then getting defensive if someone says, well, I'm really sad about this, and right away their partner says, well, but I didn't mean that. You know, they start getting defensive immediately. They can't, there's no boundary. There's no sense of separation that each can have their own feelings. And not taking it personally. There's a little slogan in Al-Anon. It's like Q-tip. Quit taking it personally. It's a reminder. So I try to help people to respond rather than to react. Responding requires thought. It requires, it's solution-oriented. It's taking a position. It requires accessing, thinking about what that person needs and wants in this situation. What do you want from the other person? What are you feeling? What do you need, you know? When you react, your self-esteem is controlled by what's going on in that other individual that may have happened 20 years ago. Okay? So, by responding, you then take charge of your self-esteem. It's empowering. In healthy relationships, each takes 50% responsibility for it. And as I mentioned, in codependent relationships, there's a warped sense of responsibility. Often one person is taking much more responsibility than the other, feeling it's all their fault, or they're working really hard to make the relationship work and the other person isn't really doing anything to help the relationship or maybe damaging it. But if there's this external locus of control, if your function is revolving around someone else, you have to control that person to feel okay. So if you can picture this, it's a haywire system where you have two people and I'm trying to figure out, let's say I'm person A and person B's there. I have to try to figure out what's going on in B's head and then I can then I'll know what to do or what to say. What are they really feeling? And then I will okay. You know, you hear women talk about when they're dating, well, what is he really feeling? Or what is he what's really going on with him? They'll spend hours analyzing somebody else rather than thinking about, well, does this feel good? What do I want? What do I need? Is he meeting my needs? You know, what do I like? What do I don't like? So not taking responsibility for your own feelings and happiness. That's crucial. And so there's unspoken contract in a codependent relationship. And by the way, if one person's codependent relationship, you can bet the other one is too. People say, oh, my wife is codependent, or my husband is so codependent. They're so needy. Well, I'll show you how that works. But there's a lot of, as I said, denial around your own codependency. So the unspoken contract is, I'll be responsible for you and meet your needs if you do the same for me. And all this leads to control is pivotal for codependents. They have to control that other person or that substance, their addiction, in order to feed their source of supply. Their source of supply, whether it's a person or a substance or a process. So I like to contrast caretaking and caregiving, and I have examples in my book. Caretaking is just that, it's taking. Caregiving is giving. So codependent caretaking is really giving love to get love. Because this caretaker only feels needed giving. No, only feels valued giving and being needed. So there's these hidden expectations on the other person that they want my advice, that they do what I say, that they, you know, that I'm important to them, that they need me. Often people will get into relationships with someone who's needy because it's insurance that they won't leave. Because underneath is this fear of abandonment that again goes back to the shame from childhood. That they're not worthy, you know, or that they can't survive on their own. And all this caretaking leads to resentment, feeling unappreciated, sometimes even used. You know, sometimes it's more often men are giving money or support to a woman and then they feel used. They're doing their caretaking in the, financially. Women do it more emotionally. So this imbalanced system gets set up. It's not mutual. So I call this a top dog and underdog. And top dog feels, it's one that's doing all the work in the relationship and feels invulnerable and self-sufficient and it's his problem, not me. They're over-responsible, they're focused on the other person, changing them, helping them. And if they don't help, they feel guilty. You know, I couldn't say no to them. And they feel sorry for themselves. It's all his fault, it's all her fault. And they feel loved if they're needed. The underdog is like the mirror, they mirror each other. And this can flip back and forth. In one relationship, you're top dog, and the next relationship, you're underdog. So, or switch over time in a relationship, or different arenas, you know, emotional versus material or something like that. So underdog feels that he or she is very vulnerable and needy, feels guilty needing help, feels more self-centered, feels sorry for himself, blames the other partner. They both feel a lot of self-pity and blame, sometimes irresponsible. And they feel loved receiving. So it's a perfect match. Underneath, they both feel a lack of self-worth. So they may feel, top dog may feel like this in a relationship. And watch out if you feel like you're doing this with a client. That would be a negative countertransference I'm going to talk about. So what's enabling? Have you heard the term enabling? So it might be bailing someone out of jail, making excuses, calling the boss, just covering up bad behavior. You know, if someone is throwing up, washing it up, getting them to bed, things like that. Making excuses to relative for when they don't show up for events and things like that. So the most powerful motivation for recovery from addiction is experiencing the natural consequences of it and the damage that it's doing in your life. Sometimes parents do this with their children. I had a situation with my son when he was around 10. He was constantly late for the bus. And I'd be nagging and after him, trying to get him to hurry up. You know, I don't know, a couple months this went on. Finally, one day I said, next time you're late, I'm not taking you to school. Because every day I would, had a detour from going to work to take him from to school. And of course that day came around. And he ran to the garage to see if his dad was home. Dad had gone to work. And he was really scared. And his little brother came to me pleading, advocating, saying, oh, he'll never do it again. He promises, please take him to school. And I wasn't angry. I wasn't nagging. I was like totally calm. And this went on for about a half hour or so. And I thought, well, I'll take him to school. I think he learned his lesson. And he was never late again. And we both learned a lesson. And when you set boundaries, when you're blaming and nagging, that's just abuse. When you really set a boundary, people know it, because you know it inside. By the way, I wrote a little ebook. I think becoming assertive is so key for not only building self-esteem, recovering from codependency, and they go hand in glove. Because assertiveness and dysfunctional communication is learned in your family of origin. I'm not going to go into all of that today. We don't have time. But it can be unlearned. Assertive communication can be learned. And I agree totally with Virginia Satir. You can evaluate someone's self-esteem by how they communicate. So learning to be assertive both is a symptom of your self-esteem, and it also can raise your self-esteem. And so I wrote a little ebook called How to Speak Your Mind, Become Assertive and Set Limits. It's only $2.99 online. So I think that and raising your self-esteem are really two key things in recovery. I'll get into that in a moment. So this simple formula, just totally, this is like, you know, higher calculus or something to a codependent. They don't get this at all. You meet your needs, you feel good. You ignore your needs, you feel bad. It's very simple. The hard part is getting them to identify their needs and then to meet them. It might include saying no to somebody else, saying yes to you. And that would feel horrible to them. So some of these painful emotions include anger and resentment. Codependents don't set boundaries. They say yes to things they don't want to do. They trust untrustworthy people and try to change other people, or of course they can't. They stay in abusive relationships, and they take other people's opinions personally. And they're also angry and resentful because they're not meeting their needs. A lot of this comes from their denial. They try to get love or from somebody they can't love. They try to change somebody else who's not going to change. They have undisclosed expectations. They expect other people to read their mind. They put people in double binds. And I saw a couple where she was angry at her husband because he didn't, I don't know, send a card or something on Valentine's Day, something like that. And so the next time he did, but then it didn't count because she told him. So she put him in a double bind. It's like, you have to figure out what I want, but I'm not going to tell you. And if you do it, it doesn't count. Guys complain of this all the time. So, and then there's anger from unresolved past trauma that keeps spilling over and getting activated in the present relationship. And if this goes on long enough, because codependency is progressive, just like every other addiction, in the end, a codependent, especially if they've been in an abusive or alcoholic relationship for many years, ends up just an empty shell. and leads to hopelessness, depression, and despair. So I'm just going to go real quickly over some of the causes and then skip to the treatment. So there's multiple factors, which I go into more detail in the book. But I want to just skip down to the psychodynamic influence. Of course, it depends on your perspective, but from a psychodynamic point of view, it begins in infancy. The individuation process starts from 4 to 6 months. And if the infant isn't getting its affective needs met, if there's lack of attunement and mirroring, it takes it as a rejection of the self. And it learns its identity and its feelings from those being mirrored back. And a parent may be giving a lot of attention, but if it's not attuned to the needs of the child, it's going to feel invasive, or it's going to feel like it doesn't discount it, it doesn't match. It's going to feel abandoned. So you need this feedback system to begin to know yourself as an infant. And then a lot of emphasis is on the family systems, which you probably studied, to further the individuation process as a child matures. Individuation goes up into adulthood. But you asked about what is a weak self. Well, a strong self is someone who's individuated. Here's a definition of it. There's psychological, emotional, and cognitive separation from the parents. So you own your own thoughts, perceptions, feelings, memories, and reality testing. You know who you are. And it's separate from other people. You're unique. I had to look to television to find a functional family. So. And these are some of the traits. That's open, there's free expression, there's fairness and respect for everyone with healthy communication, it's assertive, there's equality for all, the rules are reasonable, they're known, expressed, punishment is humane and flexible. The environment is calm and safe. It's nurturing. There's a feeling of trust and love. The family is a safe haven. It's a place where you get nurtured from, being buffeted in the world around you. And there's healthy boundaries, and boundaries reflect respect for one another. So verbal abuse is a violation of boundaries. When parents blame their children or criticize their children, that violates boundaries. Aside from, hitting and sexual abuse and more blatant things, reading their mail and invading their physical privacy. And healthy families problem solve together. They work out conflict. They help their children learn to make decisions, rather than telling them what to do. It's a big difference. I see a lot of people that don't know, they never were taught how to make decisions because they were controlled or dictated to or neglected. So that's a process that they have to learn. Oh, they held a convention for adult children of normal parents. It wasn't too successful. There's a dysfunctional family. If you remember this show, some of you may not. So it's closed and flexible, authoritarian. It's me versus we versus them. They hide secrets to the outside world. Appearances are often important, and there's no dissent. So the children learn that they can't trust, they can't feel, they can't talk about what they, even sometimes when there's, let's say, abuse or addiction going on, two children in the same bedroom that are terrified don't talk to each other about what's going on. They just have to kind of get through it all by themselves. And that's the worst part of it, that they're isolated and they can't talk. So they learn to be self-sufficient and shut down. The communication is dysfunctional, and the rules are rigid, inconsistent, arbitrary, often. They may be known and rigid in some families. In other families, you never know when you're going to get in trouble. So you're always on eggshells. You may have an addict or a bipolar parent or something, and you never know what's going to set them off. That is like being in a living with landmines. So this person always is anxious and hypervigilant. And all this destroys self-esteem and the ability to trust yourself and authority. So boundaries are usually rigid or enmeshed, and conflict is ongoing and doesn't get resolved. So what does recovery look like? It's someone who is authentic, congruent between their feelings, their values, their actions, their words. They don't have hidden agendas or say one thing but mean something else. There's integrity. They're integrated. They're whole. They're capable of being on their own and autonomous, and they're capable of intimacy, interdependent relationships. In writing this book and thinking about codependency, because this book is, especially the Dummies books, are set up in an outline format, it forced me to really think about the steps of recovery, and the book is laid out as if you're going through recovery with a chapter on all of the stages. So first is coming out of denial and starting to take your focus off of other people. So you can really focus. I'm sure you have seen someone in therapy or couples where they just blame the other person. They have to be there for themselves and make their recovery primary, not someone else's. And then starting to know yourself and build your self-esteem. And that's so important. I wrote another little ebook called 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, The Ultimate Guide to Stopping Self-Criticism. Because I think that the inner critic just can be such a barrier to building self-esteem and feeling happier. Your mood changes, your confidence, everything. And there's a lot of CBT exercises in there you can use or work with your clients for. And then healing the past wounds. Sometimes that happens later in recovery. And then the next two steps have to do with your relationships, learning to be assertive and learning to set boundaries. And then finally, reaching out to the world, finding pleasure and hobbies, developing other friends, a support system, and eventually pursuing your passions and larger goals. Except for the last one, they don't always, the first and the last, other than the first and the last, they sort of, kind of a dialectical process that's ongoing. But you have to know yourself before you can be assertive, and you have to be assertive before you can set boundaries. So there is some reason for the order. I find in trying to visualize, you know, how people change, I have developed this diagram. I think first is like knowing yourself, and then that builds your self-esteem, and then you're able to take risks. It might be saying no. It might be going to a meeting alone or a trip by yourself or something. And then you learn something new about yourself. You might find out, oh, that hurt. I can't trust that person. Or, gee, they didn't get angry. It worked out. So you're learning about yourself and your needs. That's knowing yourself. And then you know your needs more, and then it builds more self-esteem. So it's an ongoing positive feedback loop rather than a negative one. Because codependency goes through stages, progresses into healing or into illness.